Hello, and welcome to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. I'm extremely pleased to be able to announce that we have got some additional hardware in recently that should allow us to alleviate some of the problems that we've been having, especially search problems. We're about 80% through the migrations needed to get everything into the mix now, and I hope to have the new search running on a better server by Tuesday at the latest. Aside from the search being vastly improved, you should notice an increased speed on pretty much every aspect of the site. Up next, a quick update on the Novell Partner Linux driver process story that I had covered in the last podcast. A listener, Russ, had pointed out that the Novell Open Audio podcast covered the whole process and included quite a bit of details that were left out of the original articles. So if this is a topic that you're interested in, there's a link to the podcast from Russ in the comments of last week's podcast. Thanks, Russ. Now on to the news. The first story I have is Red Hat not satisfied with Sun's new Java license. This, to me, kind of did seem like an odd move by Red Hat. I know they don't necessarily get along with Sun, and there's been some clear animosity in the past, but calling them out on the distro license after Sun had announced its intentions to fully open source Java, and then giving incompatibility with the OLPC as the main reason, just seems like a miss. And for those of you not familiar with OLPC, it's one laptop per child. And I have to say, really, guys, you're better than this. I can only hope that this article was a poor summation by the journalist, which these days is certainly possible, and beyond possible, probably likely. While one laptop per child is a very amiable goal, and it's one that I really should discuss more in the podcast and even on the blog, and I will at some point, it's a topic that came up quite a bit at the Desktop Linux Summit, and it's something that's getting a lot of exposure, and it's something I do have an opinion on, so I will get to that at some point, just haven't had the time recently. It's certainly not a reason for any company to base the kind of decision that Sun is facing here on. And aside from that, looking at the OLPC specs, the Sun implementation of Java wouldn't even run in any kind of usable fashion anyways. Now, additionally, Red Hat contributes to ClassPath, which is the GNU implementation of Java, and could include that implementation, and they could include it in a pared-down version that would actually run on the specs that they're looking at for this laptop. So there was one valid reason given in the article, and that's that Red Hat would like to make some specific improvements to Java, and they're centering around real-time capabilities. And a reason that I'd personally like to see it open-sourced is, I'd guess, very soon after it's open-sourced, we'll see a 64-bit Java plugin, and that's something I'm personally interested in, as we're now running some 64-bit machines. So it'll be interesting to see what Red Hat's reaction to the actual open-sourcing of Java is, if and when it happens, and since it's almost certainly not going to be GPL compatible, that I think is going to add some interesting bits to the discussion. One thing that's pretty clear here is it consistently seems like the biggest proponents of open sourcing Java are direct Sun competitors, and specifically here is IBM. Now, along with that, you add the fact that Microsoft tried to pull what they did with Java, pretty much trying to call it Java while not being Java. And I guess this is why Sun has been so skittish on this issue. So it's good to see that Sun has agreed to actually really open source it. I hope they do follow through. It should also be noted that the article claimed that Debian approved of what Sun was doing with this, and from what I can tell in every way, that is pretty much completely false. I'm not sure where they got the idea that Debian approved from, but I linked on the blog directly to a mailing list discussion that seems to be quite the contrary. But I do have to add, if we ever reach a point that Debian approves of a license that Red Hat doesn't, I think we're in serious trouble. The next story I have is Microsoft considers taking admin rights away from employees. And this was an article that was recently featured on ZDNet. Here's a quote. As Microsoft moves its internal desktop systems to Windows Vista, the company is contemplating whether to change a long-running tradition and take away admin rights from its employees in order to improve security. End quote. I certainly think that this explains quite a bit. And while some job functions absolutely need admin privileges, and Microsoft clearly is a heavily IT-focused company, every employee at a company as large as Microsoft should not have admin rights. I think, though, that this does show the mentality of the company when it comes to security, and that mentality has certainly come through in the end product that they've produced, which has historically been ridden with security issues. Beyond that, though, this may also explain why some applications that quite simply should not require admin privileges do, and this is a huge problem in the Windows world. So if Microsoft runs everything as admin, that's the example that's being set. So programs requiring admin privileges, you can't even really blame them if that's kind of a top-down thing there. Now, sadly, I've seen more than a few companies completely give up and give people admin rights for the sole reason that it was the only way that they could get things to work, and that's just insane. Enter a decade from there of viruses, malware, and fun, and it's good to see, obviously, that this mentality may finally be changing, although, obviously, it's just way, way late. And the sad thing here is going to be, it's going to probably take 5, if not more, years for Vista to be the kind of lowest common denominator, which means we're going to see these problems for a long, long time to come. Additionally, it's going to take third-party vendors, I think, a little while now to understand the proper security paradigm, and the security issues hopefully will calm down from there. But while this is a good beginning, it's going to take a long time, I think, for us to see the full effects, and probably by then, in 5 years, maybe the Vista successor will be out. The next story I have is Mac OS X kernel source now closed. And this story seems to just be getting a ton of press with titles very close to what I just said, if not exact. Now, the odd part here is that OS X is and never, ever was open source code in the first place, ever. Nor did Apple pitch it as such, to my knowledge. While the kernel was based on the MachBSD kernel, which is open source, Carbon and Quartz and Cocoa, you name it, pretty much up a stack from there, is not open source. Does sound like a good headline, though, doesn't it? And, you know, once again, it comes back to people just trying to get eyeballs. Now, what the articles are actually referring to, like I said, is that Apple is no longer releasing the code for the OS X kernel itself, and this is for the x86 platform. They do still have it available for the PowerPC platform. Now, to be completely honest here, I don't follow Darwin too closely, but it seems to have been dead for quite some time now. Now, the reality is, Apple just isn't an open source company. They claim to support open source in their marketing, and they do in fact release a fair amount of code, but it's just not their bread and butter. Nor is it really their culture, which is a very important thing to understand. When you look at a company like, let's say, Red Hat, for instance, their corporate culture is open source. Their employees get it, but beyond that, their management gets it. It's really woven into their fabric, and that's something that's decidedly not true for Apple, whose secrecy is really a big part of what they do. It's clear, however, that they were able to leverage open source to make a very nice platform. So they do understand it from that angle, just I don't think from a cultural angle. So of course, there's just a ton of speculation going around why Apple chose to do this, and why do they choose to do it now with x86. One of the most popular theories after looking around a little bit is that it's to prevent piracy. Now, I would hope Apple has a better reason than that. It's just obvious and clear that making something closed source is in no way going to prevent piracy really on any level. It's not even going to slow it down realistically. But luckily, other theories abound. Could it be because of an embarrassing disparity between the PowerPC and the x86 kernel trees? Or does it go deeper than that? Is Apple working on a non-Mach version of the kernel and trying to slowly work some things in without people knowing that they have a big shift coming up so competitors can't react? Another theory that I didn't see as quite as popular but did look very interesting is that the speculation that Apple's working on implementing the full Windows API to enable you to run Windows applications right in OS X. And a lot of that speculation, I think, is based on the settlement that Microsoft and Apple had, which should allow Apple to legally do this. So with the next release of OS X coming up fairly soon now, I'd guess that we'll know more with that release. I, for one, am guessing that the move to x86 entailed a little more thought on Apple's backend than most people realize. The next story I have is Google follows through. Now, this is really a follow-up on a topic that I have just talked about a ton before on this podcast. The follow-up is Google has released Picasa for Linux. Now, as speculated in the past, and in something I included on the podcast a while back, it's not a native port, but more of a Wine roll-up, I'll call it. And what I really mean by that is it installs a version of Wine with the Picasa app itself. So it's obviously great to see Google follow up on this promise that they made to support Linux on the desktop side, but I do think it's a bit unfortunate they went the Wine route. There really are a lot of downsides to it, and that's the reason. First, it looks a little bit out of place when you run the app. And what I mean by that is it looks like a Windows app that they shoved in Linux. There's absolutely no window manager integration, and just on many levels, it doesn't look at home. That's, I guess, kind of superfluous, though, as long as you have the functionality. But the package includes a bundled version of Wine, so it's a huge 25 megs. And if other companies follow this, are we now going to need to have 30, 40, 50 different Wine installs? Since I have to note here, Picasa does not use a standard Wine install, even if you have one. It installs its own version of Wine, actually an opt where it installs Picasa. So if we have all the companies doing this, I think it's just going to get out of control. And what I'm hoping is that this isn't a dangerous precedent where Linux support equals Wine. I should include here, unlike a lot of Linux enthusiasts, or maybe better put, open source enthusiasts, I'm not a Wine basher. I think it is a useful piece of software, but if Linux software starts to equal, you know, runs in Wine, we will forever be intrinsically tied to Windows, and that should be obvious why that's a very, very bad thing. So I'm hoping it's used by Google here as a sort of temporary migration strategy where they can gauge demand and see how much resources they really need to put into this and also get more comfortable with Linux as an end-user platform. They obviously have a ton of Linux server knowledge, but they don't, I think, have that much as far as supporting their products on Linux as a desktop. So it remains to be seen what they do. All in all, though, of course, kudos to Google for staying true to what they said and also for potentially furthering the exposure that Linux gets on the desktop side. And one really, really nice thing to see here is that Google contributed over 200 patches back to Wine. So even if you're not interested in Google or you're not interested in an image editing program such as Picasa, it's very possible that you might benefit from this. And that's fantastic and proves that Google does get it on that level. Now, for what it's worth, I did download and install this, and it does run very nicely for a Wine app. It's fairly speedy, which isn't always the case with Wine apps. I didn't have a single crash, and I did use it a little bit. Now, Google does make three downloads available, RPM, Deb, and a Loki-based, more traditional installer. And they even contributed some patches back to the Loki installer in addition to Wine. It should be extremely interesting to see if they continue this three-release paradigm as they support more of their applications on the Linux desktop. The installation procedures and multiple packaging formats is certainly a sticking area for Linux, and how Google handles it really could set a precedent for many companies, so it's something we should definitely keep an eye on. I'll add one more story quick, and I'll pick the 25 worst tech products of all time. And I found it interesting and kind of a little amusing that three of the top 10 in the recent PC Mag 25 Worst Tech Products were of Microsoft origin. But the one that really sticks out to me is Internet Explorer 6, released in 2001, which comes in at number 8. The fact that the most current browser from a company that has a huge majority share of the browser market is over 5 years old is almost completely unintelligible. Just stop for a second and think how much the web has changed since 2001. I mean, Microsoft is really redefining stagnation with that. The other thing you have to ask yourself is, would they be working so hard on IE7 if Firefox hadn't seen its meteoric rise in popularity? And I think that's obviously no. So as you probably knew, monopolies are bad, and this really is just a single example of why. One other thing I kind of found amusing about this article as I poked around it is it seemed as if the PC Mag had given at least a decent release to a vast majority of these when they originally came out. So I guess hindsight's 20/20. That's all I have for now, but thanks for listening. And remember, if you like the LQ podcast, please head over to podcastalley.com and vote for us. Thanks.